Nothing over with Elephant Man. Before that one, Beanie Man Giants and Kingston Elephant Man, alongside Siobhan Shifter, alongside Flo Rida. Do it.
Nothing over with the thank God. They mash up, show them pray the wrong God. You know,
bring it up, bring it up, bring it up.
5 o'clock is here, okay? And that's all. So next week I see you again. Prison Radio coming up at 5, okay, which is right about now. Once again, we're telling you 1202 Bishop Angles of Reflection, all right? We're talking about the one and only, most honorable and distinctful, Lilith Nelson in the place, all right? Giving you a taste out of the book and the CD, all right? We're talking about the live performance, photograph and signature in session, okay? Right down at Mango Bay for real, 1202 Bishop. You don't know, next week I'll be out of that.
When you're having a real bad day, go on your knees and pray. On a bad day, whoa, go on your knees and pray.
Steve Knight said that.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to Prison Radio, a part of CQT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air in Montreal for more than 6 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about the prison, what prisons are, and the people inside our jail. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties between incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in sharing past archives or collaborating on programming to contact us. You can email news@ckut.ca or prison@ckut, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You're listening to CKUT Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial and www.ckut.ca online. The time is presently 5:03. I would also like to put out an invitation to prisoners, be they in the provincial or federal prisons, halfway houses, immigration, or youth detention. If you wish to contact us, you can do so by writing CKUT Prison Radio, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A 2B3. I'll repeat this address towards the end of the hour. And just a little message to Chas, who's from upstate, incarcerated in one of the penitentiaries there. Yes, I did get your mail, and I will be looking forward to doing a little research and doing some interviews about some of the subjects that you were talking about. So we'll be back in a sec. Today on our show, I'll be speaking a bit about an upcoming event, that of John Moore, a wrongfully convicted Ojibwe man, who will be speaking here in Montreal next week on CQT, as well as in a public forum. So do keep your pens out to jot down the info later on in the show. I also have some audio from Heartspeak Productions of prisoner Deltonia cook and community worker Rose Rowlands as they discuss institutionalization and what it means to be human. But first off, I'll begin this show with a recording of two panelists who participated at the Beyond Prisons Conference that took place on Saturday, October 24th. Beyond Prisons was organized by the Prisoner Correspondence Project, Action Santé Travestie et Transsexuelle du Québec, ASTEC, and the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy. The two speakers that I will air today are prisoner Peter Collins, whose presentation was pre-recorded naturally since he's locked up in Bath Medium Security Prison in Bath, Ontario, and Giselle Diaz, who has done extensive work with prisoners over the last 15 years. So to start off with today's show is their presentation at the Beyond Prisons Conference. And just a little warning, there's just one swear word in this. So if it does offend somebody, just keep down your, keep it down, you know, just lower down the levels.
First up, Giselle Diaz and Peter Collins will be have put together a joint presentation today. Peter Collins, who will be presenting via recorded audio statement, is an artist, writer, and social activist mainly working around prison issues. He has spent the last 27 years in Canadian prisons. Peter's also done a lot of work specifically around HIV prevention and peer HIV prevention programs in federal Canadian prisons. Giselle Diaz has been involved in prison activism for the past 15 years. She worked at PSAN for 7 years and is currently on contract co-writing an intersectoral strategy on HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C in prison with Peter Collins. Giselle has more recently become involved in drug policy reform and is attempting to make links between the harm reduction movement, the penal abolition movement, and sex workers' rights. Giselle has also been an invaluable support to the project, providing us with feedback and suggestions. Her work, as well as the broader work which PSAN does, continues to be a huge inspiration for those of us working with the project.
Hello, my name is Peter Collins, and I'm speaking from the confines of the Canadian Federal Prison. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak. As you are aware, Giselle Diaz and I have been working on a follow-up to the 1992 original PSAN brief. Our work attempts to identify the many hidden ways that contribute to the HIV/AIDS and Hep C epidemic in Canadian prisons. There can be no doubt that these circumstances run rampant in other prison systems around the world. I've often wondered why advocacy work in the prison context remains fragmented and largely ineffective, or with so many people in prison in North America, why have their voices remained so silent and their champions pushed out to the fringes of all mainstream discussions. Clearly, the media and the agenda-driven groups and political structures have built a culture of us and them and have effectively exploited the resulting societal division. It's been our utter folly to accept or expect that political leaders and social engineers are capable of creating significant change to the cancerous growth of the prison industrial complex. It appears to me that our efforts over the last 50 years have done nothing to stem the growth of the prison cancer. It's well past time we explore the reasons behind our striking failure and the lack of meaningful momentum in this social calamity. There are plenty of academic discussions that approach and reapproach the failures of prison, and there are a growing number of grassroots movements which challenge the status quo, but they occur in fragmented vacuums while are important and well-intentioned, serve to produce very little effect. Up until now, regardless of many amazing people on our side, this appears to be a feat well beyond our grasp. It's been beyond our grasp for too long. Why are we so ineffective? Why are we failing? Our understanding of the situation and the incredibly harmful effects of prison on the individual and society generally is an articulate, well-informed perspective, and it's correct. Yet it seems that we're speaking gibberish for all the consideration our position is receiving. We need to address these issues as if they are a political campaign, which they are, and recognize and deal with the fact that many in the community are very suspicious of change or afraid of change, and we need to neutralize or reverse the culture of fear in the mass media and in society surrounding prison. We need to work toward public re-education if we're ever to be successful. We need to learn to court political parties and provide meaningful and easily understood alternative positions. It's clear that we have the numbers to make a political impact. It's also clear that we're interlinked in the community in many ways which are as of yet seemingly unconnected. Some of the definitive separations are poverty, racism, education, illiteracy, homelessness, family violence, sexism, mental and physical disability, substance abuse, sex workers, HIV, AIDS, community groups. And without these inclusive interlinks, we will all remain effectively silenced and powerless. As concerned citizens, in prison or not, we need to implement and carry out strategic agendas that are flexible and adaptive and pushed at legislators from different angles. Our unified front should include information campaigns. We need to present our concerns and recommendations to the provincial and federal government and opposition party reps and to the parliamentary justice committees. We're blessed with many passionate, motivated, and capable people. And if we come together and help each other move toward a more collaborative and thereby more effective position, we could make changes to the culture. Changes never come without committed and passionate individuals or groups willing to put their hearts and effort into the task. I think we need to be honest about the strengths and weaknesses of our position. And from a prison perspective, our strengths are that our plight attracts some of the most considerate, open-minded, creative, and thoughtful people. As well, one of our strengths are that prisons are expensive, ineffective, dangerous, and destructive to the people who both work and are forced to live in them, and to the larger society. And our weaknesses are that we're incarcerated, the current media, political, and social response to crime, the sensationalized response to crime, the repeat of offenses by those out on parole, the lack of cohesiveness, and having no unified voice, that we're an impoverished group lacking funding. Statistically, we're not well-educated, and our public presentation sucks. The prison industrial complex's strengths and weaknesses are quite clear. In their strengths, they're already established as the only system. They're well-funded. They have a well-funded public relations department. They've co-opted many community-based organizations into complicity. They have a strong union, public opinion's on their side, mass media's on their side, political support's on their side, and they appear to have unlimited state-funded legal protection. However, their weaknesses are they're very often represented by closed-minded and angry people or angry agendas. They often think they're right about everything. They're often repressive, abusive, and manipulative. And instead of fixing obvious problems, they create cosmetic changes. Prisoners, for all their mistakes and failures, are some of the most difficult to help, and simultaneously they are some of the most vulnerable people in our community. They present as difficult, both due to their conflict with the law and the ensuing mainstream stereotypical revulsion, but also in significant part due to our individual conduct with others. Clearly, working together is paramount to our success. The inclusion and adoption of our mutually impacting issues cannot be overemphasized. However, at the same time, I see that there are a variety of hindrances and complexities which conspire to undermine meaningful collaboration. There are many examples of successful community and prison collaborations that I am aware of or that I've been directly involved in. These efforts enjoyed a measure of success due to the character and integrity and commitment of the people involved. Without meaning to discount any of the many people who I work with and enjoy friendships with, I've been very lucky to have the opportunity to meet and work with amazing people like Dee LeCompte and Giselle Dias, both of whom have provided me the opportunity to have a voice to work with others and develop meaningful friendships, community contacts, and skills. We've collaborated individually and together on a variety of projects, and that community contact and sensitivity has helped me in many ways, and I trust to some degree they've benefited as well. Since we're all here as a result of our commitment to finding better roads and building stronger and more national foundations that are, I would think, continuations of the anti-oppression framework embodied in the slavery abolition movement and the cultivated by the women's suffragist movement. It's important that we collectively move towards combining with a coherent voice the agendas of the many disenfranchised individuals and groups of people as it relates to human rights and social equity. While we're doing this, we need to pay particular attention to ensuring that all our partners are on the same page as us, or at least that they are respectful and supportive of the page that we're on. It's been my experience that some of the voices of prisoners are accepted as experts by some of the community. Some community advocates accept, completely unchallenged, the ill-chosen thoughts of a prisoner as if by virtue of the prison experience, the prisoner has somehow garnered an explicit and particularly unassailable wisdom. This is both a dangerous and an unacceptable premise. Just because someone has the courage to speak from prison does not mean that what they have to say is consistent with a message that we should either encourage or endorse. It should also be noted that if in one field of discussion they're on the same page of us, as us, i.e. Prisoners' rights, but on the other hand espouse homophobic or misogynistic attitudes and beliefs, then we need to be vigilant and call them on it. If one of our community or prison partners is not aware that they're being conservative, in the Stephen Harper sense, homophobic or sexist or racist or caustically insensitive to mental health issues, they need to be called on it. Educational evolution dictates that they need to be given the opportunity to address and change their attitudes. And while we all need to be willing to speak truth to power, we also need to be able to speak truth to each other. And if someone's not willing or able to review their own message, then we need to be willing to step away from them. They'll damage our efforts and undermine our work. We need to ensure that no one is inadvertently perpetuating misinformation or conduct that hurts our anti-oppression framework agenda. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to contribute to the work you are either continuing to work on or are embarking on now. I'd also like to thank you on behalf of all those who you work for, whether they are the marginalized in the community or in the prison system. The work you do will make society safer for everyone.
So as Peter mentioned briefly in his presentation, that he and I are co-authoring a document right now through PASAN that is updating the 1992 brief, which was one of the first documents written on HIV/AIDS in prisons in Canada at that time. And there's been several documents that have been written since that time. And for those of you who don't know, PASAN is Prisoners with HIV/AIDS Support Action Network. It is an organization that was established shortly after the brief was written and promotes health and prevention, care, treatment, and support of people living with and affected by HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C in Canadian prisons. So I had originally taken on this activity, and later on Pete came on board because I was overstressed with too many projects that I'd taken on, and he was willing to help out, which I was grateful for. Plus, I had also been working on his campaign, which took me away from being able to work on some of the things that I needed to do. And this actually presented as a perfect opportunity for collaboration. As many of you know, the transmission of HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C in prisons is a growing epidemic, and that research has shown that HIV is about 10 times higher in the prison environment and hepatitis C is about 40 times higher in prisons than in the community. And this is just to say that I think it's on the low end, as when I was in a prison out in BC just about 2 years ago, 86% of the women were hepatitis C positive within a provincial prison. So these numbers have become quite astronomical. The literature or research on HIV in prisons to date has predominantly focused at implementing harm reduction measures in prisons, so trying to implement systemic changes such as needle exchange or methadone maintenance, trying to get condoms and lubricant dental dams into the prisons, you know, supporting tattooing projects. Research or literature has also looked at seroprevalence rates, so they're just looking at, you know, how many people in prison are HIV or hepatitis C positive. And finally, there's been some research to date that look at the care, treatment, and support of people who are currently already living with HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C.
So when Pete and I started talking about this document that we're actually after the first draft we've already completed, when we started talking about, okay, what is it that we're trying to do here? Let's start talking about what's been missing from the literature and what gaps we've seen when people start talking about HIV/AIDS in prisons. And what became really clear is that we needed to start broadening the discussions around abolitionist strategies and looking at how do we stop people from going into prison and who are the people most at risk for going into prison. So we introduced some ideas around, you know, changing sex worker policy, the legalization of drugs, obviously stemming the criminalization of HIV and AIDS, addressing homelessness, poverty, ongoing colonization, and those type issues to stop people from going into prison and stop the tide of HIV/AIDS happening in the community, because obviously many of those issues interlink. And then beyond that, we started looking at, okay, what's actually happening in the prison system that perpetuates the transmission of HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C? And most people have focused on risk behaviors and, okay, so people are injecting or people are having unprotected sex. But what are actually some of the prison conditions that lead to the transmission, such as, you know, the fact that prisoners are paid, either not paid at all or paid such a low wage that this really fuels the underground market. So it means that some people might be having unprotected sex inside because they might be getting paid or they might be getting money off canteen in order to pursue that. Or looking at what's traditionally been looked at as overcrowding and ventilation, but they haven't looked at security and the increase of security that happens around a zero drug policy strategy that they've adopted, which then makes drug use underground within the prison setting. Or, you know, the zero tolerance policy for tattooing, where people are further criminalized for an activity that's legal out on the street. We also looked at things like the visiting and family contact for prisoners and how frustrating that process can be, the lack of programming. So we started just identifying things in the prison system that people who are traditionally doing work on HIV and AIDS are not looking at, because we're so focused in our limited view that if we implement harm reduction policies that somehow things will change for prisoners inside. And I think the reality is, I remember very early, I'd already been doing abolitionist work for quite some time, and then I started at PASAN, and we were meeting with Correctional Service Canada, and I had this experience as we were trying to talk about, you know, systemic changes, and they were willing to give in on a few, you know, care, treatment, support stuff, and I was like, what the fuck? This system is not working, and we're trying to reform the healthcare system in a system that's not working. And it just gets to be an impossible fight where you're just running in circles trying to make small changes, which you know that even if needle exchanges, which they should be implemented, and safer tattooing, but even if those are implemented, it doesn't make a large change in the prison population and what's actually happening with prisoners inside using those tools. So, yeah, we really wanted to stretch the way people think about reforming prisons and use this document as an opportunity to spark conversation with people who don't typically believe in penal abolition but have similar values. So we have the potential to broaden the abolition movement if we try and sell it in ways that people can hear it without feeling threatened. So part of the presentation I was also really excited about talking to you is hearing what your experience of doing work in prisons, but also sharing my experience in the last 15 years of doing prisoners' rights work and prison abolition work. And I don't want to pretend that what I'm doing has been really great or that I've affected much change, because in some cases I feel like, oh, what I've done is really just made connections with a few people and tried to offer them an opportunity to speak out in the community. But basically I've been building relationships with prisoners for that time and building friendships and relationships that I hope will benefit them as they've benefited me. So, and it's only been in the last 3 years that I've started to really look at, okay, so what's happening here? Why is it so hard to sustain prisoners' rights type community involvement and involve prisoners in the work that we're doing? Because prisons provide a pretty tangible barrier to the work that we do, and it makes it really difficult. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about it and listening to people talk and talking with prisoners about you know, what these barriers are, which I will get into in a little bit. I just want to say that I started working with prisoners' rights in the early 90s when I started with the Prison Arts Foundation, which was a pretty non-political organization at the time, but was bringing in artwork to prisoners. And at that point, I had the opportunity to talk to a lot of prisoners, most throughout all of Canada for about 5 summers, to talk about their experiences in prison and what that meant for them. And so I learned firsthand from them all the ways the system was fucked up, because before that I had very little knowledge of it. And then I started working with a group called the Infinity Lifers Liaison Group in Collins Bay Penitentiary, which was working with the lifers there, which was also really interesting. We did a lot of joint activities. We were going in once every 2 weeks. We were, you know, having parole board members come in. We were doing letter writing campaigns. It was a way of really doing collaborative work in a way that I haven't done since, actually, because we were going in on such a regular basis and you were able to do that group work together. Now, the system's changed in so many ways and makes this really difficult to do, but in some ways I think that this is going to be one of the ways that we move forward, is by going into prisons and creating those relationships with prisoners. And some of the struggles of doing this work has been finding diverse groups of prisoners to do this work with, because when you're going into the prisons and you're often going into a group such as the Lifers Group, and at the time that I was with the Lifers Group in Collins Bay, it was predominantly made up of white prisoners. They weren't integrating with, you know, other prisoners from racialized communities, or, you know, a couple of other indigenous prisoners would come in to participate, but predominantly we were working with white prisoners. And this becomes complicated in ways of organizing when you're going into the prison, because you're generally going to speak to specific groups. It's not like prisoners all, you know, will just come in and speak to you, because there's all these dynamics going on in the prison environment that we're not privy to in many ways. So I think, as, you know, white allies to prisoners in doing this work, we have a specific obligation to not be promoting that idea of white supremacy in the way that we work, and really challenging the ways that we work in the prison environment and with prisoners. And certainly I've been in that position in organizing in different ways where I've perpetuated white supremacy very unintentionally, but nonetheless I have. And it needs to be kept in check, and I think we have an obligation to work really hard to ensure that as we do prisoners' rights work, knowing that in Canada in particular that the, you know, highest rate of incarceration is for Indigenous people, and up to 77% of some of the provincial prisons in the prairie regions are Indigenous people. I've also done prisoners' work both paid and unpaid. I've worked with groups that I've worked in solidarity with individual prisoners, and I've enjoyed all of that, but found some of the individual work some of the most isolating work and difficult. It can be incredibly isolating, and I didn't understand this at first, but have started to go over it in my mind and speak with others. And it's very difficult to gather with groups of prisoners unless you're actually going into the prisons on a regular basis. And if you're doing advocacy work, it'll be more difficult to access the prisons, because then administration gets obviously quite upset about advocacy work that you're doing in that way. And as Peter had indicated in his talk, prisoners are generally connected with one or a couple of people out in the community. So as the person out in the community, you're actually bringing their voice forward, or, you know, I'm in contact with them on a regular basis. So people will call me and say, can you get Pete to do this presentation? Can you have him write this? Can you have him do that? Or, you know, and so then I ask him, he goes away and does it, brings it back to me, and then I send it to whoever else, or he sends it out directly to that person. And I realize that this isn't how collaboration, as I use in brackets, has traditionally worked in community organizations. There's much more room for dialogue that happens in that way, and sometimes that dialogue doesn't happen in those relationships because it's like task-oriented, and so it doesn't allow for that kind of general discussions that are important and that I hope we engage in today. And I think, yeah, it's important that we recognize that the reality of prisoners' rights organizing looks different than other kinds of organizing, and we need to acknowledge this and find ways of working around the barriers. And additionally, prisoners need our support, and we can't ask them to participate in political struggles and then not support them should they feel the repercussions of those struggles. So I found that working with people like Peter has been a great opportunity for both of us, as I've learned so much more and have such a great respect for the work he does. I also recognize that if people like Peter are supported well, then he has more space to do that political work. So if I'm helping him work on his campaign or help work on trying to get him out, then he has more space to add and to have a voice out in the political movement. So that means knowing details about the system and how we might navigate through all the bullshit, if it's even possible. But it means knowing what ETAs are and UTAs are, and knowing, you know, some of the language around corrections, and knowing, understanding when people have, you know, are getting their reports and asking to see if their reports, if they want you to see it, and providing feedback and direction, and really collaborating with them on their case. Because often I find that working with people in prison, they've been looking at their casework for so long, they can't see around it. So if you can look at their work and see things that they don't see, that provides a real opportunity to work together in that way. And I've not done things, or I've done things a little less traditionally than other organizers might choose to do. And I've done this for a variety of reasons. And I'm not sure if it's good or bad. I know it's caused a lot of grief, sometimes for me, sometimes for the people inside. But I've offered my place to people I've known, because I've been doing it for so long, my place for people to come to for ETAs and UTAs. So if they're coming out on an escorted temporary absence or an unescorted temporary absence, I often will get community assessments done at my house so that people can come. And I feel it's important because people don't have enough places to go to. They don't have enough community contacts. And this looks good for them so that they can then get out of prison. So on some individual, you know, level, it's about decarceration strategies and helping people move through the system and getting out of the system. I also have a number of people who I can call me at home. I'm on a number of people's pin lists so that they can call me at home, and I keep in contact through writing. And some of these people aren't involved in political work yet. And maybe they won't ever be, but I also know that people who have received that kind of support and that ongoing friendship get interested in the activities that I'm doing out on the street and want to get involved in different ways. And this is just one way of building relationships that also talks about the kind of communities we want to live in, right? It's just building these relationships is about building community. And I think we have some obligation to do that as much as possible. The Conservative government right now is looking at some really terrifying changes to policy and legislation that are moving us in directions to the U.S. And we're at a critical point. And I know Dee has done a number of radio interviews with Graham Stewart and Michael. Graham Stewart? Okay. But if any of you have not had a chance to read that report that was just released, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I think it's really important to at very least look at the summary to see what direction they're moving in, and that we need to learn from organizations that are working in the States to figure out how they've tried to combat some of these issues so that we can learn from those strategies. Because it's we're at a critical time, and it's really dangerous in the directions we're going on with the expansion of prisons. And we don't have a Canadian strategy yet. We don't actually have a group of people in Canada that are connected together to really broaden the movements in ways that we need to broaden it. And a few of us in Toronto have been talking about creating some type of national strategy and how can we do this so that we know what work's being done across the city, across the country, and that we can have a stronger voice if we move together. So thank you very much for inviting me. I was very excited to come, and I'm looking forward to hearing the other presenters and also from the people in the audience what your experience has been. And also just for the Prisoners Correspondence Project, I've just been so impressed by the work you've done and the thoughtfulness you've put into this project. So thank you.
For those of you just tuning in, you were listening to two panelists, prisoner Peter Collins and Giselle Diaz from the Beyond Prisons Conference in Montreal that took place on October 24th. The time is presently 5:33. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 by cable, and www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. Prison Radio will be back after these announcements.
Thursday, November 12th at Tiap Mezenev, Alger à deux temps. Nassima Chaban performing with Amazigh Khatib, ex-singer of Nawa Diffusion, for one night only. Swimming in a thousand years of culture and yearning for new creative impulses. Two artists on a quest for the sublime, one seeking wisdom and contemplation, the other raw, rebellious parody. Alger à deux temps, a time for the sublime that is now and the marvelous that is to come. For more information, go to www.festivalarabe.com.
The Prisoner Correspondence Project coordinates a direct letter writing program for queer, gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender and transsexual, gender nonconforming, intersex and two-spirit inmates across Canada.
The Prisoner Correspondence Project seeks to combat the invisibility of prisoner struggle and work in solidarity with sexual minority and gender nonconforming folks behind prison walls. Part of the intention of the project is to confront the ways in which our communities are policed, surveilled, patrolled and locked up. The project is always looking for non-incarcerated people, a part of these communities, to act as pen pals. For more information, contact queertrans.prisonersolidarity@gmail.com or call 514-848-7585.
His project is about trans and queer communities demanding justice and dignity.
And we're back on Prison Radio. And now, John Seymour, an Ojibwe man from Serpent River First Nation, was convicted of second-degree murder in 1978. This happened despite the fact that he was not present when the crime was committed and had no role whatsoever in perpetrating it. His trials were tainted with systemic racism. Through two trials, John was charged and convicted by all white juries, though in the surrounding area of Sault Ste. Marie, there were numerous First Nations communities to pull jurors from. John Moore will be coming to Montreal to speak of his struggle to find justice and freedom. Justice and Freedom for John Moore is a committee supporting an innocent Indigenous man's struggle for justice and freedom in Canada. They are asking organizations and individuals from across Canada and elsewhere to endorse the statement supporting John's demand for a review of his unjust second-degree murder conviction. The address to his blog is justiceandfreedomforjohnmoore.blogspot.com. John has already received a list of prominent individuals who have signed on to his blog, such as Glenn Thibault, Member of Parliament, NDP, in Sudbury, Ontario, and Will Morin, former First Peoples National Party federal candidate. Also, organizations have signed on, such as the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, Aboriginal Peoples Alliance of Northern Ontario, and the Sudbury and District Labour Council, to just name a few. There is quite an extensive list. John Moore will be coming to Montreal to present his case to the Montreal public. You are invited. This event is free and will be taking place on Wednesday, November 18th, between 7 and 9 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. It'll be located at the School of Community and Public Affairs, located at 2149 Mackay. And that is, nearest metro is Guy Concordia. The exit would be Guy. If you can't be there, but you would like to know more about his case, you can go to his blog. The address again is justiceandfreedomforjohnmoore.blogspot.com. Here is a short clip of John during an interview I did with him last June.
And the bottom line is that I keep reminding the government, I said, you know, which is crystal clear, is the fact that I did not kill Mr. Lanthier, the cab driver. And I mentioned, I told him, I said I was sorry for what happened to the man, but unfortunately, it was me that killed him. I didn't stab him, and then I didn't have control over my co-accused. What they did out of volition of their own self. Mm-hmm. They did it by themselves. I didn't twist their arm. Mm-hmm. And then I also mentioned that, you know, all these things that just, as much as I can, I just keep reminding them that I'm innocent. I did not kill Don Lanthier, unequivocally. I did not kill that man. So therefore, you should do something about it and not wait until I get old and gray and then do something, and which might happen here.
So let's not wait until his hair turns gray, as he says. Come out and hear John Moore speak about his ongoing struggle. Again, that's November 18th at 7 p.m. at 2149 Mackay Metro, Guy Concordia. This event is free. And for those of you who cannot be there, and especially for those who are incarcerated and would like to know more about John Moore, you'll have the chance to hear John Moore because he'll be here on CKUT the evening prior on November 17th on the Native Solidarity News Show. So tune in next Tuesday, November 17th, between 6 and 7 p.m. This will definitely be a show you do not want to miss. The time is presently 5:39, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 by cable, and www.ckut.ca online. I'll be back in a moment after these messages.
Monday, and Thursday.
Look for the McGill Daily
in Shatner,
McConnell,
Leacock,
Arts,
and numerous other locations.
Read about news,
culture,
commentary,
and letters.
Read it in class,
while riding your bike,
while taking a shower,
or while having sex.
And best of all, it's free.
You can also listen to The Daily's weekly broadcast, Tuesdays after 5, here on CKUT.
Open Door Books has been sending books to prisons across the U.S. and Canada for over 15 years. We regularly send to immigration detention centers, youth detention centers, as well as federal and provincial prisons throughout Ontario and Quebec.
Open Door Books relies entirely on donations of books provided by the Montreal community. We are especially in need of multilingual dictionaries and language books, how-to manuals, bestsellers, and books on Indigenous issues. You can drop off books at Cooper Concordia at 1500 Demisenive West, at Le Cagibi at 5490 Saint-Laurent, or at Head and Hands at 5833 Sherbrooke West.
Open Door Books seeks to support incarcerated communities and work in solidarity with prisoner struggle. For more information, email bookstoprisoners@gmail.com.
You're tuned into Prison Radio, and up next is prisoner Deltonia Cook speaking with Rose Rowlands. I do have a bio for Rose Rowlands, who I have featured on Prison Radio before. Rose Rowlands is from the Kaskadena First Nation in the Yukon. Ms. Rowlands is a member of the Wolf Clan and since 1989 has been involved in developing culturally and socially appropriate justice programs in the Yukon. She has worked for the Kwinlan Dun First Nation for 15 years and established the Kwinlan Dun Community Social Justice Program, where the main focus was healing, community involvement, and utilizing the circle to facilitate these objectives. Ms. Rowlands is a qualified instructor and coach in the Justice Institute of BC, with conflict management, mediation, and dealing with anger courses offered at Yukon College. She is a justice of the peace, a practicing mediator, and presently runs her own management and training business. So again, here is prisoner Deltonia Cook speaking with Rose Rowlands as they discuss institutionalization and what it means to be human.
There's this CNN report, this news report, this little kid, they were at the zoo, and this little kid was climbing up on the bars to the gorilla pit, and the little kid was pointing at the gorilla and everything, and he fell in. And someone was videotaping this, someone outside was videotaping this, and all of the people, we were all horrified when this little boy fell into this gorilla pit. And there was a sign that said, I think, don't feed the gorillas and don't climb up on the bar because you might slip and fall in. But he was too young to read the sign and too young to really understand. The little kid fell in and we were horrified because this, what we would call this beast, this animal, he was in there with this beast. So this gorilla runs over there to the kid, and we're all horrified. We're watching this on CNN. And the gorilla gently picks up the little boy and holds him and grabs him and then takes him to a safe place and protects him from the other gorillas. And when I looked at that, I thought about that recently. And I thought about it. I said, that's life. That's how life should be. And it takes an animal, a beast, to teach us what life should be. To me, I guess you can look at it in any way, but to me, those people standing out and the person filming this kid climbing up on that fence, it's us, it's our society. And the little kid is our future, is our youth. And that and climbing up on the fence, that represented life and the trouble and the mistakes that youth gonna make. And when he fell in and hurt himself, that gorilla to me represented the justice system. The system, our system. When our kids fall in and get in trouble, the justice system, this is what they're supposed to do. even though they look like a beast and our kids potentially come into prison to be hurt or whatever, the justice system should come, because the justice system is us, and be merciful to that child, to be compassionate to that child, help that child and protect that child like the gorilla did. Yet in society, when we look back and look at that, none of the people were fast enough or stopped that child from climbing up. Everybody, they saw the child climbing up because they filmed it. They filmed the kid on the fence. They filmed the kid falling in. So people saw the child getting in trouble, saw the child in trouble. And the child, he too young and too inexperienced to really know what that sign meant when it said, don't climb up and don't feed the gorilla. We need to be as merciful to our youth, because they all are youth, just as merciful to that youth as that animal, that gorilla, that beast was to that one child. And I challenge any and everybody to go back, look it up, CNN, I'm sure you remember it, and think about it. Look at it over and over again and think about it. Think of the fear, like everyone, the millions of people at home watching that, and how your heart stopped when you realized that kid had fell over in that gorilla pit. And because you knew this animal was supposed to come over, and that's what the justice system do. The justice system beats, destroys, tortures, and kills our future, our youth. That's what they do when you think about it. When you throw your child, when we throw the youth into prisons and don't have mercy, don't have compassion, throw them into prison, put them in adult prisons, lowering the age, that's what you think about what you're doing. Just because that child didn't come from my wife don't mean that ain't my child, and don't mean that's not my responsibility. Think about it.
Well, it's about perceptions too, and I remember seeing that on CNN, the gorilla, and it was the fear of the gorilla, and at first, and what is this gorilla going to do to this already harmed child who was unconscious, and this, you know, and everybody standing around is afraid, and you hear the whoa and oh no in the background, and it's a perception that we've created in society. And I think it really links to what you were saying, because you know, even driving through the gates for me today, you know, I've been in the Yukon Correctional Facilities, and you know, I've had good friends, I've had, you know, people that I've known throughout my life who've been in those environments, and when you go through those gates, you have this perception and this feeling that it's like the fear is there. These are people who should be here, and so on. There isn't these are human beings that are institutionalized, that are it's a fear that we have generated in society. I think many of us are becoming prisoners. I think most of society is becoming prisoners. We're becoming prisoners to the institutions that are governing our lives, that are controlling our lives. And as human beings, we're beginning to feel that in extreme ways. I've worked in government settings. I've worked in institutional settings. And I always tend to go back to a more fluid, kind of free-thinking environment where I feel like I can be human. I feel like I can cry when I hear a story. I feel like I can have a bad day. I feel like I can make mistakes. Our laws are becoming so constricting that they're creating fear in our society. I think we're all living to some extent with that. And it's, you know, it's driven by human needs to want security and stability. And some people in this world aren't born with that security and stability. They're born into survival mode. And to survive in a world where everybody is individualistic and thinking only of themselves it can become a very cold society. And You know, and I guess it just makes me think of that. That initial perception of the whole public's view of this gorilla was that gorilla's going to harm that child. Whereas, again, it took a CNN type of thing to say, wow, and everybody was moved by watching that huge animal that go over to that child and realize that that was a child who needed, or a child who needed to be connected to, who needed to be protected. So rather than putting that gorilla into, a danger mode or a violent mode, it reacted with, I'm going to nurture and protect this child in this environment. And in fact, when the ambulance came to, when they went to take the child, the gorilla was almost protective, keeping them away. You know, it just assumed that role, and, you know, it's a great analogy when you think about it. Our reactions today have become very fear-based. And I think, again, back to that issue, many of us are feeling somewhat imprisoned by the restrictions. We're in an unnatural world, and human beings are wanting more natural, real spaces to be human. And they're becoming less and less and less. I mean, we have schools that have 3,000 kids in them, 40 kids in a classroom. Our children are going into daycare at a year or 3 months old, you know, and coming out the other end of institutions. Maybe if they've been successful in institutions, they're coming out the other end after 30 years of being in institutions. And then we want them to be free thinkers and to be human. You know, and then we have another part of society who isn't so blessed to be successful in the institutions, and they're born into environments of poverty, of abuse, with First Nations. They oftentimes, their families are fragmented right from the word get-go, I mean, and other cultures too, and into foster homes and group homes. And then they graduate into the young offenders facility, and they end up, you know, in our prisons and jails. And they're just doing another, they've got another institutional kind of, you know, they eventually graduate from the penitentiaries, if ever. And that's same for people who've been successful in institutions, you know, hoping for retirement if they're lucky. But many feeling quite imprisoned by it.
And yes, that was Deltonia Cook, as well as Rose Roland, speaking about institutionalization and what it means to be human. And that is something that I'm going to be speaking with other guests for the next Present Radio show, which will air on Friday, November 27th, between 11 a.m. and noon. The subject will be mostly around restorative justice, and I'm really looking forward to that upcoming show. The time is presently 5:53, and you're listening to CKUT at 90.3 FM. And yes, I'd like to thank Heartspeak Productions for sharing their audio. They have many different audio clips. They do wonderful videos all on the subject of restorative justice and what that means, and how it's been used in different communities, whether in a prison setting or outside of a prison setting, to avoid people actually having to go and become criminalized, though unfortunately that is not used near enough as it should be up here. But for more information on Heartspeak Productions and to learn more about restorative justice, you can check them out on the internet, www.heartspeakproductions.ca. Again, I would like to put out an invitation to prisoners, be they in the provincial or federal prisons, halfway houses, immigration, or youth detentions, or even for all those prisoners that are located in the different prisons, such as in Malone, New York, which is upstate New York, that do tune in to the Prison Radio show regularly. And we do appreciate having your mail and to be in contact with you. And yes, so that address again is CKUT/Prison Radio at 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A
2B3. And also check out the Justice and Freedom for John Moore event, where John Moore will be speaking about his struggle to get exonerated here in Canada. And for those of you who want to learn a little bit more, what does it mean to have a life sentence in Canada, that even if you do eventually get out of prison, that you are on parole for the rest of your life, and what that means, what kind of conditions, and etc. There'll be also Gabby Petticelli, who will be speaking about giving a short little introductory course just before John speaks. And again, that is on November 18th between 7 and 9 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. This event is free, and it'll be taking place at the School of Community and Public Affairs, which is located at 2149 Mackay, Metro Guy Concordia, Exit Guy. You can also tune in to Native Solidarity News next Tuesday between 6 and 7 p.m., so that's November 17th, to hear an exclusive discussion with John Moore on his case, as well as how other issues regarding the incarceration and criminalization of First Peoples of this land. And I think I'm going to put on a song, for it's so seldom I even have some time to put on a song, but I am going to put on a song. And let me see, we're going to be playing, it's a Folsom Prison Blues, which everybody knows of Johnny Cash, but this is going to be a cover done by Christ on a Crutch.
Hear that whistle blowing, it's coming round the bend. Why it's in the sunshine, it's the prison, time keeps dragging on. Here, whistleblowing, the medicine at home. When I was just a young boy, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy to play around with guns. Shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. Here, whistleblowing,
there is this thing. Do you realize?
Consciousness is affected.
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
You've been listening to Prison Radio. We air the second Thursday of every month during the off-the-hour slot. We invite anyone who is interested in sharing past archives or collaborating on programming to contact us. You can email news@cqut.ca or prison@cqut.ca or by calling 514-448-4041, extension 6788. My name is Dee and I've been your host today. Thanks for listening. Upstage is next.